and welcome to Moonwise, a monthly podcast featuring conversations with women of power. I'm your host, Dorte Sophie Royal, and in this episode, we bring you my conversation with Indigenous scholar and community organizer Lila June Johnston about leadership, service, and humanity's reciprocal role with nature. Her perspective feels especially important in this time of quarantine, where we're getting mixed messages about humanity's role on the planet and what is possible for the future. Before we begin, I want to thank you and our growing community of Patreon subscribers for making this show possible. Special gratitude goes out to Krishna Avalon, our newest Patreon subscriber. Please join us at patreon.com/moonwise, where I'm sharing a guide to herbal remedies for this moment and lots more. Okay, on with our show. Lila June Johnston is an Indigenous environmental scientist, doctoral student, educator, community organizer, and musician of Diné, Cheyenne, and European lineages from Taos, New Mexico. I interviewed Lila's mom, Woman Stands Shining, in episode 12, if you'd like to check that out as well. Lila recently ran for office in New Mexico, where she brought issues like climate justice, peak oil, and Indigenous science into her platform. In January of this year, my family joined her in Santa Fe for a 7-day fast for the future, which she completed, and in the process, she brought to light so many important issues that feel more relevant than ever today. The film that my husband and I created over that incredible week will be available online soon, so I'll keep you all posted. Hi, Lila. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I wanted to start by having you introduce yourself to our listeners who may not know you yet.
Sure. I'll introduce myself in my native language first. Yat eshik e arosh de ne eshe e nanish eje trachi in a shlin don haskai de ne bashishi ashi hedisha che bilagana eda chanelle Taos, New Mexico de nasha akwit ego de ne as aninishli. My name's Lila June. I'm from the Black Charcoal Streak Division of the Red Running Into Water Clan of the Diné Nation, also incorrectly known as Navajo. I grew up in Taos, New Mexico. I currently live in Santa Fe. And in that manner, I introduce myself as a Diné woman. I'm honored to be here and thinking of my people as I'm here. I'm a scholar, musician, and community organizer. And really integrate my elders' worldviews and my elders' teachings with my training at Stanford in anthropology at UNM in Native American pedagogy, and currently pursuing my PhD in Indigenous food systems, blending that all together to inform my perspectives and solutions.
I was really eager to connect with you now, especially because of something you shared recently on social media about humanity and our interaction with nature. What I'm noticing is there's a lot in the news about nature regenerating, and we're excited about that while we're in quarantine. And at the same time, it doesn't necessarily imply that the earth is better off without us. It's not like humans are designed to be a plague on the earth. And what you said, and I can quote, human beings were designed to be a keystone species upholding whole food webs and ecosystems. And I was wondering if you could tell us about that and how we can better act in that way.
Yeah, I think there's a common misconception, in my opinion, that human beings are a plague to the earth. We are a curse. And if we were just all eliminated and disappeared, the Mother Earth would be so much better and she'd be so much healthier. And we're just these problem childs of creation, and we're these misfits, and we're these outcasts of creation. But that's not true, because there are instances throughout the world and throughout time where human beings actually are an essential component of the circulation of nutrients, the circulation of an amplification of biodiversity. And I've spent the past 2 years really studying that very intensely in my PhD process, and visiting different tribes and seeing how they interact with the land. And I know that there's two elders that I will mention now. One was a His name's Leroy, comes last. He's from the Fort Peck Reservation. He said that everything was created for a reason. I said every rock, every star, every tree, every deer, every horse. And then he looked at me and he said, and every human, you know, and it's like, you know, you can follow along with him about the stars and the trees and the horses. But when he gets to human, you're like, oh yeah, we are a part of this. Creator doesn't make things on accident. You know, each and every one of us are meant to be here. None of us is a mistake. And that sort of mentality guides a lot of what I do. Then you have another elder that I overheard giving a speech at the Parliament of World Religions over in Toronto a couple years ago. And he was the Yoruba elder who's from an African tradition. And he said that that his people call human beings chosen ones. And I thought that was funny sounding at first, because like, oh, we're the chosen ones, we're so special. But he went on to say, no, we're not so special. It's that we were chosen by Creator to take care of the land and to be her nurturer and to be her steward. And all of a sudden it made sense. So maybe that's why we have these big brains, that Creator actually designed us. And we were chosen to be an important part of ecosystems. So I'll just lay that out at the beginning just to help frame kind of my thinking and how I view humanity. But then there's also evidence of this. It's not just a principle or a philosophy. When you go out in the world, I've seen the Heiltsuk Nation in British Columbia hand planting kelp, and tons, I mean tons of kelp in the shoreline, so that when the herring come to spawn, they have surface area to lay their eggs. And they single-handedly, literally, increase the herring roe biomass by probably 400-500%. And so what you have is these human beings be an integral part of the food web, because who eats the herring roe? Not just the humans, it's the salmon, it's the killer whales eat the salmon, and then the wolves eat the herring roe, and everything feeds off of the herring roe. And so these people noticed that, and they said, wow, if we can boost the herring spawning ground, then we can boost the whole ecosystem. And they do to this day. That's on the island of Bella Bella, British Columbia. Then you have the Menominee, who I was really honored to spend a few weeks with, not much time, but they have a forestry department where they have this little tiny reservation, right? The little tiny scraps of land that they were given by the process of colonization. And they actually thin the forest and harvest lumber from the forest on a rotating basis. So they have hundreds of parcels, and each parcel gets harvested every 5 years. And what you have is an endless supply of lumber. And they actually have a lumber company. And instead of depleting the forest, this process of actually thinning the forest and giving it a little room to breathe and cutting away the younger trees and letting the old growth stay has actually increased the biomass of the forest. Over the past 100 years that they've been doing timber and lumber, they've actually increased the biomass of the forest by, I forget how much percent. Then you also have the example of the Shawnee in Kentucky. When the Shawnee were in Kentucky, they had created a food forest, black walnut, hickory nut, chestnut, and acorn. And we know this because you can look at the sediments in the ponds and the fossilized pollen that is inside of those sediments. And what we see is about 7,000, or rather 3,000 years ago, the forest completely changes from a cedar and hemlock forest. All that pollen goes away, and suddenly there's this influx of black walnut pollen, chestnut pollen, hickory nut pollen, different types of oak. And so what you have is you actually have proof that this whole forest was transformed into a food forest. And then you also have the influx of fossilized charcoal. And so that fossilized charcoal shows that they managed this food forest with fire. And so you really need fire to have a healthy ecosystem in, especially in the Southeast, because it's so lush and dense and there's so much rain. And so you really need to have someone to thin the forest and make room for understory for the deer, decrease competing vegetation, blah, blah, blah. So it's really not that humans are supposed to all disappear and the land will be healthy. The land actually needs our touch. It needs our presence, and it needs a little bit of stewarding and pressure to make sure that if we just left it alone, it would get overgrown and become a cedar and hemlock monoculture. So you actually need human beings. You need human fire to create biodiversity. You need human fire to stop the successive growth. I know I'm talking a bunch of lingo right now, but what I'm trying to say is there's many examples of this where human beings are so good to the earth that if they were to leave, it would actually dismantle the entire ecosystem, and that she would actually miss us. And so a keystone species is just that. And I'll end this part by saying this is beavers are considered to be a keystone species because when they build their dam, they create habitat for all kinds of fish, all kinds of birds. Even the moose come and eat the vegetation and all of this stuff. And so if the beavers were to go extinct, which in many places they did because of the fur trade, you have the collapse of all of these ecosystems. And so similarly, human beings are meant to be that way. We are meant to be like beavers. We are meant to be things that take care of the land, influence the land, impact the land, but in a way that's not self-serving and selfish, but in a way that's generous to all the species all around us and upholds that biodiversity. And perhaps that's why the native peoples only oversee a fraction of the land around the world and hold tenure of it, but we oversee 80% of the world's biodiversity, according to a recent report. So I'll stop there, but that's just something that I've been noticing is that the answer is not for humans to just stay home in their houses in quarantine and everything will get better. The answer is for us to go back out into the world, but in a completely different way, where we are actually being good to her. We're not harvesting her for our own gain, but we are supporting ecosystems and food webs all around us.
And as you speak about going back out into a relationship with nature that's different than what a lot of the mainstream culture has taught us or perpetuated, what are some of the qualities that you've seen that are similar among these indigenous societies that are interacting in this reciprocal way with nature? Like, I'm curious if to you it's about, you know, paying attention to nature, listening. Like, what would those qualities be that maybe aren't as cultivated in modern life?
That's an excellent question that, to be honest, I'm still answering for myself. But if I think about it, there are a few characteristics that you see in these different tribes and these different communities across the board. One obvious one is to diversify genes at every opportunity possible. I was honored to go to Villarrica, Peru, which is way deep in that jungle. And when I sat down at the restaurant to order juice, you know, or to order food, they ask, what do you want to drink? And the juice menu has like 20 different types of juices on there. And I'm just like, whoa. And these fruits are fruits I have never seen in my life. And in American culture, what do we get? Apple juice and orange juice. That's about it. Maybe cranberry juice. And so these supposedly primitive people in the Amazon had 30 different juices to choose from. And so I think it's really important to diversify genes as much as possible. But, you know, McDonald's is all about standardization and making sure that your customer gets the same thing every time they go through the drive-thru because they like familiarity and they like to be able to control things. So if you do that, you'll make more money. But because we have standardized things, such as the banana, it has to be a certain length, it has to be a certain width, it has to be a certain color. We are actually going to experience a banana collapse within the next 10 years because if one virus figures out how to hack into that genome, it's going to wipe out all of these bananas because they're all exactly the same. But when I went to Quetzal, Puebla, there's a beautiful banana there that is about 3 to 4 inches long. And I ate it, and I've never had such a delicious banana. It wasn't normal to me, and it wasn't what I thought I would was going to expect from a banana, but it kept me full longer, and it was nutrient dense. So that's one thing, diversify genes. Another thing is to not be afraid to influence habitat. I think a lot of conservation biologists really just want to never touch anything and just let the land be. And all these national parks around the world, they literally kick out indigenous peoples because they view them as pests. They view humans as pests. It's all these fancy conservation biologists who have these fancy degrees and think they know everything about saving the planet. God bless them. They kick humans out, and then these forests and places get overgrown. They have a lot of issues, and the humans who used to live there actually increase the biodiversity through human fire, etc. So one example is with the Heiltsuk Nation, again, the clams will only exist a certain depth below the shore, below the water, right? So the Heiltsuk noticed this. So they actually went in and made the shoreline elevation a little bit higher, because as you walk deeper into the ocean, you go deeper, deeper down. They actually put boulders in the deep areas to bring up the elevation of the shoreline so that more clams could exist. And that's a form of aquaculture that's very beautiful, because you're not really domesticating anything. You're not controlling, you're not putting the clams in a fence. You're actually just creating more habitat, and the clams will come to you. So that's what I mean when I say don't be afraid to shape habitat and generate habitat that certain things like. And one more example is the buffalo, right? The buffalo throughout the Great Plains, people don't understand that the Great Plains were shaped by human fire, deliberate, seasonal, low-intensity burns, such that if you look at a lot of the lunar calendars of Native peoples in the Great Plains, they usually have one moon that's called the smoky moon or the burning grass moon, because this was part of their regimen. This was part of their seasonal practice. Every time at this year, we're going to go out and burn the land in patches. So you reduce the risk of catastrophic fire because you've reduced the fuel load all over the land, and you've injected the soil with nutrients such as potassium and nitrogen, and you're creating all of this biomass of grass into nutrients that goes into the soil. And what you have is a regrowth. They call it pyrodiversity, diversity that flourishes after fire. And so you have a lot of seeds that are activated only by fire because they co-evolved with humans for so long. And so what comes back is this nutrient-rich grassland. And guess who loves nutrient-rich grasses? Buffaloes, deer, and other ungulates. And so a lot of people say that we followed the buffalo across the plains, but it's the contrary. The buffalo followed our fire, and we knew how to bring the buffalo to us. And I heard one elder from California say that his old elders used to say to him, if you see the deer are dwindling, if you see the deer are hungry, do a burn and the deer will come back. And so this is like incredible quote unquote traditional ecological knowledge that still rests in a small handful of elders throughout the land. And we desperately need to not just broaden our horizons, but shatter our horizons and be like, we don't know, you know what? We don't know anything. We are in deep need of a complete makeover in how we view food, how we view water, how we view human land roles and interactions, and just admit that everything we've been taught is a lie.
You're here. It seems that an overarching theme there is not so much about control, but about collaboration, and that there's a difference there. And I 100% agree with you that it is a lie, and it has been a lie, and we are now seeing the repercussions of those lies. It's not working, just point blank. And just the fact that anyone would consider humans a pest, what does that say about how we see ourselves as being so much not belonging to this planet that we were actually born on? It's, yeah.
Yeah, there's one extreme. There's the conservation extreme where you don't touch anything. And then there's the other extreme where you just control every little piece, like a monoculture farm, where you plant a certain genetically modified seed that's a clone of all the other ones every 6 inches, and you feed it this much fertilizer and this much water. And so what I'm talking about, yeah, is somewhere, it's neither of those. It's neither complete, utter control and domestication of life, and it's neither the hands off, don't touch anything, you're going to hurt the earth. I don't know if it's somewhere in the middle or just somewhere completely outside of both of those paradigms, but this idea that you can touch the earth, you can sculpt the earth in a way that is good for not just you, but for everyone. So that's maybe a third principle that you're getting at, is it's a lot of these nations and a lot of these communities and a lot of these tribes, their land management practices are expressly for all beings.
Well, that's a great segue to talking about food sovereignty, and in particular in this moment that we're having of this quarantine, and people are noticing that there isn't food in the grocery store in the way that they've been accustomed to. It seems like there's an awakening happening about how important it is to understand where our food is grown and to cherish our farmers. And yeah, I'm curious about your perspective on why you think this is happening, and what do we need to keep in mind in order to include equity and social justice and awareness of Indigenous practices?
Yeah, I went to, in Santa Fe, there's this thing called Natural Grocers, and it's like a health food store. And I walked by the seed section and they were all gone. And I was like, wow, people want to plant seeds. That's awesome. And it's all because of the coronavirus, right? Like, we're starting to realize that we cannot rely on the grocery store system alone. And I think this is really important that we're getting a preview, because what we really need to be worrying about, in my opinion, is not coronavirus, although that's a huge important thing right now, but peak oil. You know, peak oil, unless the government has some magical energy source that they're just hoarding and waiting to release at the right moment, we are going to be totally screwed when it comes to peak oil, because all of the food in the grocery stores is delivered by freight. And that freight relies on the incredibly energy dense substance called petroleum. Nothing has that energy density that I'm aware of, aside from perhaps nuclear energy. And even that is not as nearly energy dense as petroleum. And you also have not just food coming by freight, but pretty much anything in the room around you was shipped to you from China or somewhere very far away. And so localization is, I think we've had a nice foray out of a local life for a brief period in human history. But just like Creator made humans for a reason, I also think he made our legs the way they are for a reason. And he didn't give us a V6 engine built into us. He didn't give us tires. He didn't give us the ability to travel across the freeway at 70 miles an hour. And maybe, just maybe, we're not actually meant to do that. Maybe, just maybe, we're not actually meant to live at these speeds and have this globalized culture. Maybe, just maybe, we were created as localized beings because that is our nature and our design. And maybe, just maybe, that's okay. Maybe that is enough. Not only enough, but if we were to trust that local nature of ourselves, we would learn beautiful things that we were put here to learn. And that same elder from Menominee Nation, Gary Bisa, that I got to hang out with for a couple weeks in Wisconsin, I told him we were flying back. I said, well, Gary, we're going to fly back to New Mexico now. And he said, oh no. And I said, what? He said, well, I'm going to put some tobacco down for you. I said, why? He said, cause you're not supposed to go up there. You're not supposed to go way up there in the sky. You know, if Creator wanted you to go way up there, he would have given you wings. And I was like, wow, you know, like maybe we're actually this idea of having enough and trusting in enoughness, that maybe living on the ground is enough, and not just enough, but absolutely beautiful if we take the time to see it. But getting back to food sovereignty, I think that we're all starting to realize that we need to have a localized food system, and we need to have a locally interdependent food system, and we need to have knowledge of seeds and soil and water and everything else that goes along with agriculture. But as you can see, my research doesn't really focus on agriculture. It's more of a indigenous land management intersected with indigenous food systems, and realizing that you don't necessarily have to plant a seed to have food. There's food all across the land if you know how to enhance the natural food bearing capacity of land on a regional scale.
Speaking of indigenous wisdom and science, I have really admired and respected all of the work you've been sharing around leadership and particular indigenous perspectives on leadership. And I've also watched you embody this as you were running for office in New Mexico recently. And I would love to touch on those concepts a little bit here, as I know a lot of folks are feeling very confronted by uncertainty right now, and also a lot of confusion, distrust of our leadership currently in this country and perhaps around the world. And I really want to be able to tap into some alternative views on how we can actually come together as people and move into the future together.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that. Obviously, running for office was an extremely beautiful and also brutal experience, seeing the depths of, however dirty you think politics are, times that by 700,000, it is ugly in there. It is an ugly, ugly place, and they're desperate to maintain their power. They will turn against you. They will turn your own people against you. It's an ugly place. And so props to anyone, literally anyone, who goes into politics because they actually care about the people, because they are knowingly going into a place of profound unethical and dirty behavior. And I know quite a few people who are doing that now. I know classmates of mine who are running for office and who've won. I know Indigenous women and men who are stepping up. And a lot of times they get punished for it, just for having new ideas, just for having a heart that beats for the people. It's really ugly. But my professor was talking about it recently, and he said that American democracy is kind of set up to fail. And he said something very interesting. He said the 4-year term limit, it makes people very short-sighted. It makes people focus very heavily on re-election. And so you're kind of darned if you do and darned if you don't, because if you have a long-term limit, then you're stuck with someone that you don't really like. But if you have a short-term limit, then you have politicians who are thinking at most 4 years ahead. And you were with me in Santa Fe when I was doing my 7-day fast on the Capitol steps, and I was holding a sign that said, think 7 generations ahead, and running on a climate platform and running on a platform that deprioritized revenue from oil and prioritized future generations that won't have a planet to live on if we keep doing that. And, you know, that's what I was trying to bring into the picture of, like, you know, we live in a political world where decisions are being made by people who only have a 4-year limit, sometimes 2 years. And so they're not really thinking, their decisions aren't always about 7 generations ahead. And so I think they are reconcilable, but not unless we make a very conscious effort to say, even though I'm running, even though I'm only going to be in leadership position for 2 to 4 years, everything I do needs to be about the next 7 generations to come. And to think on that longitudinal scale, you know, then we can really, really be the leaders that our people can be proud of. But the other thing you and I talked about was, you know, the Sitting Bull paradigm of, here in New Mexico, there's this thing called the governor's mansion, and the governor sits in a mansion, you know, and that's where they live, kind of like the White House, you know, like there's these positions of privilege and positions of special treatment for our elected leaders. But I really like what the Pope did early on in his papacy, where he went to a small little home. And that was a statement. He said, you know, I could have the Pope's castle, but I'm actually going to this little room here and have a simple life, because maybe, just maybe, like Sitting Bull said, leadership isn't about getting a red carpet rolled out for you. Maybe it's actually about having the least and making sure your people come first. And so that's something I think about a lot too. I mean, there's probably a lot more I could say about Indigenous leadership, but I'm forgetting that my other colleagues and contemporaries would be a lot better at discussing. But those are just a couple of things that I think about, and the predicament we're in with the American democratic system. It's clearly not working. So I wish I knew a little more to say on that, but I think all of you who are listening, it's up to all of us to think about how can we reform this and completely restructure it so that it's shares with all, and that it thinks about all life, and not just all life, but all time, 7 generations forward and backward.
Yeah, right now feels like a pivotal moment in which we do have an opportunity to choose in which direction we want to go in for the future, as we all kind of take this step back, this pause. And, you know, it is such a unique time we're living in, and it feels like there is potential also for a lot of divisiveness to grow as people are searching for who to blame for their suffering and for all these changes. And I'm curious about your perspective on, you know, how you see what is possible for humanity coming together in a shared vision for the future, as opposed to like just starting to turn on each other and being like, no, it's your fault that, you know, it's China's fault, or it's, you know, all this kind of pointing fingers.
Yeah. I think sadly we can't control what other people do, and I don't think people are going to stop acting stupid anytime soon. So I think we just have to expect that people are going to be selfish, short-sighted, and blaming each other, like you said, and that's not going to stop. However, there is also going to be a very large faction of humanity, as we're seeing all over, who are just going to exist outside of that and are going to do the real work. I mean, running for office, for example, people were pointing fingers at me and trying to dig up dirt on me because, you know, I started doing drugs when I was 11 years old, and I was a drug addict by the time I got to Stanford, and I didn't stop till I was 23, and I'm 30 now. So they had plenty of crap to pull up on me. I'm not a perfect person. I don't have a perfect past. But who is actually going to do the work? I mean, why are we talking about that? I mean, accountability is important, but are we using that as an excuse to distract people from the actual task at hand? And I think a lot of people will not be distracted by this stuff. They will say, you know what, we have masks to deliver, we have elders to protect, we have food to deliver. And I see that all over Indian country right now, is so many beautiful Native leaders stepping up and just saying, I'm going to go deliver $2,000 worth of groceries and cleaning supplies to Zia Pueblo, who has over 40 cases of coronavirus and only 900 tribal members. And they just do it, you know? So I think, yeah, I mean, I wish I could say that I thought that world leaders would start acting mature anytime soon, but I don't know. And if they don't, I think true leadership is going to come from the ground up, and true leadership is going to come in the form of each and every one of us. And true leadership might not be seen, you know, might not be seen on the world stage. It might not be seen even on the national or state level stage. It might be something that kind of like, you know, some of these keystone species who are not so obvious, you know, like the earthworm in some parts of the world, you know, no one sees them, but they're the reason for healthy soils in some parts of the world. And so maybe that's what leadership will look like as well, is it will look like something you can't even see.
I love that. Maybe we can all be more like earthworms in our own neighborhoods.
Yeah. And I know I just found out that earthworms are an invasive species in North America, so I have to be careful. But there are indigenous earthworms in Kentucky and in the South who have not gone extinct, although they are endangered species. But yes, there are some earthworms who are very, very good for the soil, and we need them desperately.
Yeah. So the idea being is not so much about the accolades and the image, it's about, and I do think people are doing this, like really just stepping up and like helping their neighbors and creating mutual aid networks and delivering supplies and really starting to prioritize our vulnerable populations. I'm even seeing here in Portland, I mean, suddenly all the hotels realized they could house homeless people, like, or unhoused people. They're just like, oh, wait, we have rooms. People need rooms. I'm like, wow, it took a crisis for us to figure this one out.
Yeah, exactly. And I think leadership and societal organization was always meant to be decentralized. In Dene culture, you know, we now, we're in what is now called New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, and Utah. But we never had a centralized government, you know, and we didn't get one until 1930 something. And at that time, our entire indigenous leadership structure was dismantled and replaced with an imposed puppet government, really. And now we have a president. Now we have like the same thing as Congress, but on a tribal level, where you have little representatives going to the Capitol, and people are disempowered. But in the old days, from what I hear, we had family units, clan units, and little smaller scales, and many leaders. You know, dozens and dozens and dozens of leaders who are all equal and all looked after their family units and their clan units. And so I think going back to that is probably the way to go. And obviously women's leadership was a very important part of our culture. We were always a matriarchal society, always. And now we have never had a single female tribal president, and we have tribal delegates who are the equivalent of representatives and senators, you know, who are women. Very rarely, every now and then, a woman will win a race. So, you know, that's important too. But yeah, decentralization, and like I said, not being seen so much is probably where we're headed.
And is that in your mind a step towards empowerment and sovereignty for people at this time?
Yeah, absolutely. Because sovereignty is not just being able to feed yourself, but being able to lead yourself. And it kind of comes down to capacity of, like, are people capable of leading themselves? Do they have those skills? Just like the big agriculture and all of these corporations intentionally de-skilled. That's my new favorite word lately, de-skilled. We are a de-skilled population, kind of like when you clip a bird's wing and it can't fly anymore. Like, we've been clipped and we can't take care of ourselves. So that, I think that applies also to leadership sovereignty, is like, does a community know how to self-organize? Do they even know how to do decision-making together? Do they know how to take care of the land together? Do they know how to operate as a community? All of that has been taken away from us by individualistic capitalism, behaviors that we all know and love in some ways, but all have sacrificed a lot of important skills to have.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know in my family, we're really looking at, wait, what do we know how to do on our own? And the list is at this moment quite short, but step by step, I'm like, okay, I need to learn how to sew and mend and carpentry and identify plants. Just all these things that I'm like, wow, I've really been so dependent.
Yeah, yeah. Just like de-skilled is one of my new favorite words because it helps me finally have a word for what I feel. But another one of my favorite words is reskilling. So reskilling the population and training and teaching the people how to have these skills is kind of my passion and a lot of people's passion right now.
How can our listeners find you online and best support your work or the work that you feel is really potent at this moment?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to slow down a bit and not do so much work. So you might not see a whole lot coming out in the near future. But I do, I am a creative being and I can't really hold still even when I try. I definitely have content kind of constantly coming out through my Facebook, Instagram, on my website, and my YouTube and things like that. So, there's definitely that stuff. But that's all Lila June, LYLAJUNE for Facebook, for Instagram, for YouTube. My website is Lila June Johnston, JOHNSTON.com. And, all my books and writings and all of my, music is on there and all of that stuff. So yeah, that's sort of where it's at right now. And yeah.
Are there any particular causes or issues that you're seeing in Indigenous communities or in New Mexico at large that you feel like could use some attention or some support from folks, even if they're far away?
Yeah, so we have a COVID-19 Native Relief Fund, and we give small grants, emergency grants, like, you know, maybe $150 to $200 to families who are just without a paddle. And we're unique in that people can apply very quickly and very easily. And there's also the Native COVID-19 Action Fund, which is an Indigenous-led, grant-making, empowering, visionary, Indigenous, women-led initiatives. And so she, Sarah Eagleheart, you know, she's really important to watch right now. She's very tied into the philanthropy world as a Native woman and really good at getting resources to the places that need it most. Indigenous Environmental Network, IEN, has their COVID-19 Emergency Mutual Aid Fund. What's unique about this fund is it's actually supporting Indigenous peoples from Alaska all the way to Patagonia. So from North and South America. So that's really cool that they're very tied in on more of like a global scale to Indigenous peoples. So that's really good to donate to. Of course, there's the Navajo Hopi Families COVID-19 Relief Fund, which is by all accounts been one of the most effective relief efforts in Indian country, and they're just kicking butt. So if you Google any of those things, you'll have a GoFundMe pop up. And I'm sure there's more. That's just what I know about right now. And obviously one of the big projects I've been working on, which is not about funding, but it's more of a political thing, is the Mashpee Wampanoag Nation, which are the original peoples of Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Again, incredible aquaculturalists and incredible food scientists. Brilliant, brilliant, beautiful people. The Trump administration is trying to disestablish their federal lands in the middle of this COVID crisis. And they just won 45 days restraining order from the federal government, but when that restraining order is up, you know, God only knows what's going to happen to them. And they have a big hearing on May 7th. So if you want to check out dw-webinars.com, we did an action training of like how you can be a solidarity with them. And we have three major actions that we're asking people to do in the coming weeks. So that's a big one that we're focusing on right now too.
Make sure to link to all of these in the show notes so that people can find them very easily. Thank you, Lila. It's been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you for all of the research you've done, your service to the community, your leadership, your creativity. Like, there's just so much to say thank you for, and just really cherish who you are as a person. And I'm so grateful to know you, and I really am happy that folks are, you know, getting the opportunity to explore these ideas through this episode. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And thank Creator, because all of this is Creator's doing, and I really can't take any credit for any of it, because He gave all of it to me and all of it to us. So so thanks to Him, her, it, they, however you conceive it.
Thank you for listening to the show. You can hear other episodes on moontent.co or subscribe to the Moonwise podcast on iTunes or Spotify. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us on iTunes and leave a review. You can also leave a comment on the Moonwise Sisterhood group in Facebook. Our theme music is by Sophie Cooper from her album Rewilding. She's sharing her offerings over at voicealchemy.com, so go check her out there. See you next time.